This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Gary Grant has made it his life's work to fight racial discrimination. He was arrested more than a dozen times for civil disobedience as a student in the 1960s at what is now North Carolina Central University in Durham. He helped integrate the Boy Scouts in eastern North Carolina by bringing the first troop of African-American scouts to a jamboree at Camp Bonner in the 1970s. And for the past 30 years, Gary Grant has fought for the rights of African-American farmers. He leads both the Concerned Citizens of Tillery and the National Black Farmers and Agriculturalists Association. Those groups help black farmers keep their land in the face of discrimination and discriminatory loan practices. Gary Grant is my guest today on The State of Things. Welcome back to the program. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Nice to be back with you, Frank.
You were raised on Unit Number 50, the Tillery Resettlement Farms in Halifax County. What were the Tillery Resettlement Farms?
The Tillery Resettlement Farms were a government program that made it possible for African Americans to become landowners and homeowners, primarily those who had been sharecroppers. And also it wasn't just for African Americans, it was also for white sharecroppers who had been working for others as well. You were qualified through a process and you were able to get a house that had probably 2 to 3 bedrooms, somewhere between 40 to 60 acres of land, a barn, pasture land, garden spot, an orchard, everything that it would need for a family to be self-sustaining.
It's a program that came out of the New Deal.
Came out of the New Deal along with the Social Security and the electric lights going out into rural country, the rural electric co-ops that were established.
And where did the land come from? The government is buying up
the government bought it from large white landowners who were having trouble right after the Great Depression and the 1920s. And it seems that this government is always willing to take care of the big boys, but not necessarily the small ones.
So it bought that land, got them out of trouble, sold the land. It didn't give it away.
Right? No,
the government
not.
Wasn't giving the land away, but it was giving a chance for, as you say, sharecroppers, people who didn't own property before. Here's your chance to get in.
Exactly.
And it helped both black and white farmers, although apparently when the land was sold initially, the choice land did not go to the black farmers.
No, never. I mean, even the land at the turn of the century, blacks owned somewhere in the neighborhood of about 16, 17 million acres of land, and a great deal of that was in what would be lowland, wetlands, near rivers and all. So all of the land that has ever seemingly been sold to blacks was that kind of land that was not supposed to be the most productive. In Tillery, the Tillery Farms, the government was actually going to do a social experiment with blacks and whites together, blacks on one side, whites on the other. In the 1930s, the land on the banks of the river were being sold to whites. And one day someone decided, whoa, wait a minute, what happens if it floods? And as a result of that, there was 10,000 acres of land that was being made available to both black and white. And the government ultimately purchased an additional 8,000 acres of land, moved the whites to high ground, as we call it, about 15 miles from Tillery. And in 1940, the river did do exactly what they feared, and it flooded. But then the land was being sold to black people.
So. Mm. And black farmers went right back after that.
Went back afterwards. Many of the farmers who suffered the 1940 flood left because floods come right at harvest time, and therefore just as the hurricanes today. So you lose your crop for the year, and it doesn't take long for that to send you into bankruptcy or to tell you you need to go somewhere else and try to make a living.
So what was it like for you growing up on that farm?
Well, growing up for me, I had two brothers and two sisters, so we were pretty happy, go lucky. We worked hard. Neighbors were close by. Communities were actual communities where people worked with one another, shared with each other, and were very proud of the accomplishments of what each family would obtain. I remember the family that got the first TV and we were all going to their house every evening after work to watch television. You know, TV wasn't even on for 24 hours. It was like you might have 5 or 6 hours a day. So it was good. Basically, eating well, being educated, going to school, and having opportunities to share and be shared with.
That said, you've said that there was a kind of a two-tiered social system. Your family was a little better off than some of the farmers.
Well, in Tillery, we actually had two communities. Those we are referred to as new people, the New Deal resettlers who came in and became landowners. And then you had the sharecroppers who were still working on the large farms that local white landowners owned. And farmers in the Tillery community, in the New Deal community, actually got to be the middle class blacks next to teachers and preachers, while the farmers, the sharecroppers, were still suffering the same kind of suffering that all of us who had been sharecroppers were suffering.
And your father had not been. He had not been a sharecropper.
My father had not been a sharecropper. He comes from landowning right after the out of slavery, as my great-grandfather purchased land and made it possible for a school to be built and brought in a teacher and that he paid himself off of his land. My grandmother and grandfather also bought their own land and would not go into debt after that. Mm-hmm. They worked hard to get that paid off, but if they needed a chair, they would save the money until they had enough to go and purchase it. So I have the landowning coming from my paternal side and sharecropping coming from my maternal side.
And through it all, those families understood the value of both land ownership and education.
Exactly. If you own your land, it gives you a sense of independence and that you are not subjected to the rules and regulations of the society at that time. And for example, we could go to school when our parents said so, not when the large landowner who you were working for, as a sharecropper would say. We went to school many days, and the children there were mostly those from the resettlement community. And we wouldn't see children from the what we could term old Tillery for almost 6 weeks or so before they came back.
That said, land ownership did not shelter you from the reality of racism.
Oh, no, definitely not. At that time, blacks were not allowed to vote unless they could read and write a portion of the Constitution. In Tillery, a group was formed called the Tillery Improvement Association that took on these challenges and also took on the local school board as to why black children were walking to school while whites were riding, why were black schools getting cafeterias and white schools not. And even in 1954, after Brown versus the Board of Education, it was the children from the Tillery resettlement were the ones who were taken to the white high school to test to see if they could be enrolled. Of course, none of them got enrolled, but at least the testing took place. My mother was the first woman out of the resettlement to become a registered voter. She was the first woman to have a driver's license and all. She was also the salutatorian of her class, and we think she and my dad were the only two high school graduates that we found out of about 300 farm families. And that, after they got married in 1940, they were in Newport News, Virginia, where he worked at the shipbuilding, but also attended Hampton Institute, where he was certified as a mechanic and a welder. So
all of this might have brought you to the attention of the local authorities.
Probably did, but one of the things that we've discovered is that local authorities have respect for you if you are respectful for yourself. Hmm. And they did, as a matter of fact. Once upon a time, they found a liquor still on property that my dad was renting that we knew nothing about. And we are pretty sure that it was put there to set him up, because at that time he was working probably in the neighborhood of 1,500 acres of land. And this farm was owned by a local white who had leased 1,000 acres of land to a black man. That doesn't work real well in the 1950s and 60s.
You actually witnessed a cross-burning.
Oh, yeah. A cross-burning. There was a former junior college called Franklinton Center, which is now Franklinton Center at Bricks. And Dr. Judson King would hold summer work camps with from youth members primarily of the United Church of Christ from across the country who would come. And our job for the summer or the two-week period that they were there would be to paint and rehab the buildings, the original structures. And once in, I think it was 1954 or 55, as the local white community discovered that blacks and whites were inhabiting together, not cohabiting, just inhabiting together,
yeah, right.
That that night they came, and there were about five or six, I remember it very distinctly, five or six men with hoods on their heads and the white sheets, and they put up a cross and set it afire there on the campus.
How old were you?
I would have been about 14 at that time.
What impact did that have on you?
Well, I think that it just probably reinforced what I had already been taught. If you're coming from a home where parents are saying you're going to get an education, you stand up for what is right, you fight for justice, you don't leave other people out, I think that it probably just reinforced what had already been seeded.
And you had an opportunity, I guess, to meet with white kids and understand some of the prejudices, some of the things that they had been learning at home as well.
Well, we definitely had opportunity to meet with them. We had one young guy who was from the – his grandparents were from the South, and that they had taught him that black people had tails. And I just remember distinctly we were – they had these communal showers, and we were in there showering, and he kept leaning back trying to peep around behind me, whatever it was. And finally I asked him what was he doing, and he told me what his grandparents had taught him, that black people had tails. So I turned around and let him see that we were normal, just like him, and that there was no tell, and actually we are still very good friends today.
On the State of Things Today, talk with Gary Grant, State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Stay tuned. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Today, talking with Gary Grant, founding president of Black Farmers and Agriculturalist Association, based in Tillery, North Carolina, advocates on behalf of black farmers who have lost their land because of racial discrimination. So you grew up on the farm, but then left home for Durham. What were you doing? What brought you to Durham?
One of the pieces out of the New Deal and the resettlers was that you understood that you were going to get an education, and we probably have a high number of high school graduates and college graduates from areas like that. And I entered North Carolina Central University, which was then North Carolina College at Durham, in 1961. Had an aunt who preceded us there when it was North Carolina College for Negroes. You know, so you've got the whole history level piece going there, and I've had a niece who has actually attended North Carolina Central University. So each generation has been along the way.
You've got all the banners.
Got all now, the banners, right.
What was the political environment like?
The political environment at that time was the fact that Durham was a segregated place. You couldn't eat in restaurants together, and you had churches that were still segregated. And the new Howard Johnson Motel restaurant had just been built out on I-85, probably maybe a couple of years before I arrived. And that was where my first arrest took place, as we tried to eat in the Howard Johnson restaurant out on I-85. And from there, becoming a member of the NAACP on campus, as well as the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, SNCC, and working with CORE, Reverend Dr. King. So, and there was a cafeteria on Main Street. I can't think of what the name of it was, but that just refused. Other agencies were kind of breaking down a little bit, but this place just refused that blacks were going to eat there. And one day we were targeting like 10 places at the same time, and I was to lead the group that was going into the cafeteria. And we go in and we get in line, and of course the owner comes to tell us that niggers are not served here, and we don't move. And he says, "I've told you, and you need to get out." And the next thing I know is that he has a double barrel shotgun that's probably 6 to 10 inches from my face. The police officer is standing there, not saying a word, not even moving. And you begin to think, now, is this the day to die, or do you you know, you kind of calm down a little bit. And we did actually back out. But the policeman never even made an effort to take the gun or to do anything to secure our safety.
It's interesting because Durham did have a reputation as being one of the more progressive places in the South. But I guess we shouldn't forget that.
Well, we shouldn't forget. I think places being defined and who's defining them oftentimes tells the story. And so because the media was controlled by whites, as much of it is still today, that the story gets to be that perception and what it is, how we want to see it. Then you never talk to real people who actually witnessed. You know, I also was the first to sit downstairs at the Carolina Theater, the first black to sit downstairs at the Carolina Theater, as we targeted that once. And there stands the owner in the door with his arms and legs spread right in front of, you know, the full length of the door, and a big football player from North Carolina Central with his arms, you know, and they're like nose to nose. And so while they are arguing, I weighed about 15-17 pounds, so I just slipped through the legs and went on in. No one ever even saw me, you know. So, and it's just a matter of who's telling the story. But Durham was a very racist place, and city government did not do that much to help move it forward at that time.
What were your intentions? Why were you going to school? You certainly grew up on the farm. Were you planning to go back?
Well, going to school was part of the entree of what land ownership would do. And no, I had no intention of going back to the farm. As a matter of fact, I'm sandwiched between – I'm the middle child of five children, and I was sandwiched between two brothers. Luckily for us and most of the children in the community, your parents supported your dream. And I actually wanted to be a Broadway actor, believe it or not. So I was here studying under one wonderful woman by the name of Mary Bohannon, and who had headed up the drama department. And my mom says to me one day, "Now, just what are you going to do when you get out and you can't get on Broadway?" You know, in that reality had never even set in. So after that discussion, I then took a minor in English and speech education and ended up going back home teaching school.
Well, I would say, given your story of how you got into the Carolina Theater, you could always – you have a great story about how you broke into show business.
Yeah.
Pardon me. I'm really sorry.
Definitely.
So now they're your parents breaking their backs growing food, and you're saying, "Oh, I want to go off to Broadway." But they're supporting you in this.
They're supporting us, and we're supporting ourselves, because we would – in order to go to college, you had to, like, pick two bales of cotton before in order that you could get the tuition paid. My parents were very progressive. And in the 1960s and late 50s and early 60s, you have this transition from the mule working the land to mechanization. And many of the farmers then did not survive the transition, because you don't really make enough off of 40 acres to do tractors and plows and all of that. And so some of the farmers began to look for off-farm work and began to lease their land out. And my parents were visionaries. They knew that land was important, and that growing food and the other crops of peanuts, cotton, soybean, and corn was important. So they loved the farm, actually came back from Newport News, where he was making a good living in the shipyard, back to the farm in order, because they both loved it so much. So they began to lease land, and eventually we ended up owning four of the units with somewhere around 200 acres of land.
Oh. And what did they grow?
Majorly corn, peanuts, cotton, and soybeans. It was interesting that the government was building tobacco houses, curing barns, up until they decided to move all the whites off the land. And when they did that, then they decided that the land was no good for growing tobacco. So, and not only that, they began to take off rooms on our houses that they were building so that they could build the new barns in the new community.
And the problems in the program were not only in the way that land was distributed initially, but also in the way that it was administered, the loans in particular.
Definitely, the way that it was administered. And even though they had what they called a black man that was a supervisor there in the Tillery area, he was still subject to the whites who were running and the government agents who were running both the Tillery and the Roanoke farms. Roanoke was what was the white resettlement. Mm. Eventually that we all got to be the Roanoke farms. I've never understood you move the whites 15 miles away from the river and you name that settlement Roanoke. And we're in Tillery on the banks of the Roanoke River, and we'll call Tillery, which was a town that already existed. So,
And in terms of administration, we should talk about some of the details. There were something called supervised loans for African Americans.
Well, after the flood in 1940, the resettlement administration was disbanded, and we got what was known as the Farmers' Home Administration. By the 1950s and 60s, as farmers were now dealing with this agency and the government is creating new kinds of programs and all, so they had what were known as land ownership loans, operating loans, and equipment loans. The white farmers could put in their applications, and by early January or February, they had their money. Blacks would put in their applications at the same time and would get notices that they had their loan somewhere in March, April, May, maybe by September. And those loans were called supervised loans, that the farmer never put the money in his bank account. He always had to go to the office, the FMHA office, to let them know what amount of money they needed. And in most cases, for example, if you needed a repair part for your tractor, you had to go to the tractor repair parts, get the invoice for how much it was going to cost, drive another 30 miles to get to the FMHA office, and then 30 miles back to get the part after you had sat in the office there waiting for the local white agent to see you. As white farmers came in, went out, go in, and go out. It was really a very, very disheartening and difficult time.
And not only the administration, obviously, if you're not getting your loan or the money until May, it's a little late to be buying seed.
A little late to be buying seed, or you have definitely missed the primary window for the best crop that could be gathered during that season.
And then foreclosures also became a problem.
And then foreclosures become a problem. You have I don't mind talking about my family's problem. So my parents did not borrow from the government, the USDA, its equipment and operating loans until the early 1970s. And so, and between 71 and 76, there were three declared disaster years in Halifax County, two of them with too much water, and one was a drought year. Yet the only people that were being foreclosed on were black farmers and landowners. There were two white farmers who were foreclosed on who did not own land. They were leasing some of this 10,000 acres that had been made available to black people. So you are now being foreclosed on because you haven't been able to make your loan. You've educated your children. Your children are working public jobs. They come to assume the loan, which was one of the processes that could be done. And ultimately, probably between 76 and 81, the final statement to my father as we sat there saying, we want to assume this debt, is that the agent looks at my father and says to him, Matthew, it doesn't make any difference who you go see, who you bring into this office. We are going to sell you out. Well, now, when you're going to sell him out, that means you're going to sell me out and my brothers and sisters as well. that my parents had five children of their own biologically. They took a relative at 6 months, so there are six of us, we say. And then they took two members from my father's side and two children from my mother's side. So they actually ended up raising 10 children with no assistance from the local Department of Social Services or anything, because we were all taught to work and you go and you make a living. You don't depend on the government for that, but you do depend on the government to treat you fairly.
Yeah, and so this was happening, of course, not just to your family.
Right.
Lots of farmers were losing their land as a result of this.
Exactly. The farmers in the area were losing their land, and this is how the concerned citizens began to address that land issue by creating what was known as a land loss fund, where we raised money to help farmers plant their crops. Some were so bad off that they literally could not pay their fuel bills or their heating bills. They couldn't buy groceries. But with our connection with other teachers and people in small businesses, we were able to bring a group together to form that organization and begin to help these farmers.
This is Concerned Citizens for Tillery, and you also helped produce a documentary film called The History of Tillery Resettlement Farm.
The History of the Tillery Resettlement Farm, that's known as We Shall Not Be Moved, The History of the Tillery Resettlement Farm. Yes.
And in that film, there is a woman, one of the residents there, Dolores Amundson, and she talks about life on that farm and the way people were quite independent.
Neighbors helped each other. I remember hog killing days, and everybody killed hogs, and everybody would go to House A and help them with their hog killing. And then maybe next week someone else would do theirs, and everybody went over there to help them with theirs.
So there we have it, free of government assistance, people right. off there doing for themselves and each other and getting things done. And those farmers are getting thrown off the land now in big numbers.
Exactly. And not only did we help with the hog killings and all, farmers would help each other even with the harvest so that to ensure that everyone could survive whatever catastrophes or, if your tractor broke down, you still can't leave your peanuts in the field. They have to come out. So the hog killings brought us close together. Then if you needed help with the harvest or even with the planting, it was a community. And that's what community does. Community looks out for each other, not the kind of stagnation, separatism that we are being exposed to, I would say even today,
yeah.
where we have people who are buying the land who know nothing about the history of the community, and all they want to do is just, well, for whatever reason that they're doing it, tax write-offs or coming in just to hunt, but they have no relationship with the people who are still living.
Who was buying that land initially as black farmers were being thrown off?
Primarily the whites, and we've not been able to prove this just yet, but I wouldn't doubt that they weren't the cousins and the nephews and of the county committee members. This is the only agency that I'm aware of in the government where a committee makes a decision on who's going to get a loan and who's not, and that is called the county committee, and it is comprised of landowners and farmers. Well, in 1950, 60, 70, you don't have black people serving on this committee. So why would a white farmer want to see a black farmer succeed when he's in need of some more land? So between racism and economics, he kicks in and says, oh, well, we can get that one for my nephew over there.
Particularly as mechanization makes these economies of scale more important
to
local farmers.
Right.
So this is all happening. I guess we should point out it's a federal government program. It comes out of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, but it's administered at the local level.
It comes out of the U.S. Department of Agriculture at Washington, D.C., but it is administered at the local level, and it's always written in languages like you may. It's not you will.
Mm.
You might. Anything that allows that freedom for the local agent and the local committee to be the ones to make that determination.
So what was it like for your father to be foreclosed on?
Devastating. One of the things, black people have always thought that the federal government was their protector. So here you are in a federal program that has made it possible for you to become a landowner by creating a program that allows you to buy land and home. And now this same agency has allowed a local agent to decide that you should not have this land anymore. And my father was very quiet. He did not cause trouble or anything like that. But he was truly devastated. I remember very clearly the day that the federal marshal showed up and gave them 30 minutes to remove all of their personal belongings because they had – and there were probably 15, 16, 18-wheeler bed trucks parked along the road that had come to take all of his equipment and everything away. And he just very calmly said, you can't do anything until my lawyer gets here. This is probably 7:30, 8 o'clock in the morning. And the agent says, well, where's your attorney? And he says, in bed, probably where you should be at this hour of the morning. And we were able to hold them off. I had a sister at the time who my oldest sister was doing television at Channel 9 in Greenville. She had the first talk show in the area, and I believe for the state, and especially for a black woman. So we had some connection with the media, and within 30, 40 minutes, helicopters were landing in the yard from WIL. Which kind of scared the agents, because they didn't want this kind of publicity. Nor did the Farmers Home Administration want this kind of publicity, as they didn't want it and don't want it in what they have done to farmers through the Pickford class action.
Talk a little bit about that lawsuit.
Well, the Pickford class action was filed in 1999 that accused by a young man here in North Carolina, Timothy Pickford, accusing the government of racism in its practices of its farm lending policies. And it was at this time that, even though we had been working in Tillery, that we discovered that, oh, this is happening elsewhere. And then in 1996, in December of 1996, there was a protest held in front of the White House, where we discovered that it was not only happening in North Carolina, but that it was happening all across the country. The government was accused of practicing – its agents practicing racism, delaying and denying loans, not offering programs to blacks as they were offering to whites, and just really wreaking havoc within black communities and on black farmers.
Tell you what, we'll talk about the outcome of that lawsuit and the future for black farmers in America with my guest Gary Grant on the state of things when our conversation returns. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking this hour with Gary Grant, an advocate for African-American farmers. Gary's executive director of the Concerned Citizens of Tillery and president of the National Black Farmers and Agriculturalist Association. And before the break, we were talking about a class action lawsuit, Pickford versus Glickman. So how did that resolve?
Well, eventually, to keep from going to court and having these horror stories actually publicized, the government did settle in 1999 for $2.4 billion, which would have paid a number of farmers $50,000. However, $50,000 was not what the farmers went asking for. They literally went asking and demanding that their land be returned. But the government decided that we were worth only $50,000. Yeah. So if you were able to prove your case, and we had at that time probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 32,000 and 35,000 black farmers who file claims, but only 12,000 of them were actually successful in going through. And what we discovered was that the farmers who were still farming didn't make it through the process. Those who had lost their land, lost their homes, many of them had lost their marriages, you know, had this horrible scene that the children had witnessed and all. So they didn't make it through. And then as you went further south, there were many local papers that didn't carry the story. The advertisement was on cable TV, and you're going, what farmer in 1980, you know, in rural Mississippi is going to have cable TV or direct TV out there? So what happened was there was a flood of applications that came in right after the deadline for that, and that is what President Obama signed on December the 10th in 2010 was the second part of it that allows – many people think that farmers have already gotten the money. They have not gotten the money. This just simply says you will have the opportunity to try and prove your case. As we look at it, many of the farmers are dead. Many of the farmers are health-wise has deteriorated. Right. Many of them have been put off of their land and all, and children have probably destroyed much of the paperwork that would be needed in order to get them through this process.
What you have to prove is there was actual discrimination. A white farmer in a similar situation got better treatment than you did.
Right, exactly. And you have to name the white farmer. However, they have removed that from the second portion. But in the first portion, you had to name the similarly situated white farmer who got funded when you were denied. There's also a process called the administrative process, to which my parents were in at the time that Pickford was filed, had proven their discrimination because an agent who was coming to negotiate with them came in wearing a Confederate necktie. With these boys marching with their flag flying and guns on their shoulders, and you're coming in to negotiate with somebody about how we're going to settle this case. But at any rate, the discrimination was proven, and all of a sudden the Department of Justice stops everything because, we don't know what the Pickford case is going to be. So whether you
let me just – I do want to stop you there. The proof was not just that he was wearing this tie. He actually had the documentary evidence on the
– Right. Exactly.
I want to clarify that.
Yeah.
So he had documentary evidence that white farmers were treated better, and he proves it in an administrative – this is outside of the actual case, separate administrative
remedy
that
Pickford
he was
case,
pursuing.
Right.
Okay.
And the thing is that you are so brazen that you can come with this kind of a tie or you're so brazen that you can have a hangman's noose hanging on your wall so that when the farmer comes in. I mean, you got to remember that these farmers are coming out of the early 1900s. The average age of the farmers was 62 at that time. So they know what's, and you're in the South, you know the signs, you know what the message that is being sent. And whether he meant to send that message or not, he just picked the wrong family to come dressed with that tie that day. At any rate, we get stopped. So you have the administrative process that was going fine. You have the now you have Pickford. And you must remember that under Reagan, the whole civil rights office at USDA was basically closed down. There was no funding for it. So farmers who were filing discrimination complaints, their files were just being thrown into a room in boxes and all. And we had to literally get Congress to lift the statute of limitations in order for many of them to qualify. Now back to December 2010, when President Obama signs the bill, we have some 63,000 plus farmers or farm families that are now who had late claims that were never adjudicated, never looked at. They just sent them a letter saying, your claim is denied because it was late. And so we go back to the 1930s and 40s when you discriminated against us by putting us in floodplains, by charging us more for land that you say would not raise tobacco, which was the cash crop, and setting white farmers up in another. So discrimination with the farmer didn't just start in 1981, but the Pickford class action only covers that 15-year period from 81 through 96. And my parents were not in Pickford. They eventually joined a lawsuit called Wise versus Veneman. Each time the Secretary of Agriculture changes, the name on the lawsuit changes. And there were probably 13, 15, I can't remember the exact number, of farmers who were in that lawsuit. And we were not only after the land, getting the land back and being compensated for what the government had done to us, but to change this process at the federal level that continues to allow local agents to continue to practice racism without being questioned. And in December of 2010, these farmers' cases were dismissed. And in January 2011, the court actually just put them out and said, you need to negotiate. And in my parents' case, where we are basically at this point paying the government for having discriminated against us.
Paying how?
Paying them cash dollars.
But for – in what form?
Pardon me?
How so?
We had – because the – let's see. The lawsuit, the claim – the – hold on just a second. I'm 68 years old.
Well, I was just trying to think of why you're having to pay them. Is this
because the – somewhere or another, I think that the lawyer didn't do the very best job. Mm. Even the – every farmer is still having to provide the name of that similarly situated white farmer, and he didn't get it in time or whatever happened. And so therefore, they say we can dismiss this case. The debt of $57,000 in a 30-year period is now worth almost $200,000. So they negotiate down to half, and we are now paying that half, $100,000, to the Department of Justice for the USDA after having proved the discrimination all along the way.
What do you know the statistics on black farmers today and how many there were and sort of how many we've lost over the past several decades?
Well, let's see. In my community, we had 300 black farm families when I was growing up, and today we have four. North Carolina has lost 92% of its black farmers in the past from 1981 through to 1996. Mm. And so family farming for blacks is pretty much a tale of yesterday. White family farmers are also in trouble because we have – everyone believes that corporate agribusiness is the way to go, that they can feed us better than we can feed ourselves. We have all of these corporate businesses, for example, the hog industry, where in the 1970s we had some 10,000 family farmers raising pigs in North Carolina, and today we have probably three or four companies raising 10 million pigs, and we have more people hungry than we had back then. So something is definitely wrong with the process.
There are some small indications that sustainable agriculture is at least gaining traction. And with the unemployment rate being what it is, there are actually young people now seriously considering going back. We're looking at the economics, and people are reconsidering whether or not sustainable agriculture could feed the country. And there are pretty good signs that it could. Is there any indication that African-American farmers or African-Americans would be part of this turnaround?
Well, I think that African-American farmers will be, and young people will be a part of it. It's not going to be in the massive numbers that we probably see young whites doing it for, because they have not witnessed what the young or middle-aged black person who was on a farm has witnessed. For example, my nieces and nephews would never consider going into farming just because of what they've witnessed happening to their grandparents. I think that for blacks, we are probably doing more urban farming, gardening, than that may bring the children of that generation. And they are also the ones who left the country, quote unquote, the farm, and went north, you know, to Chicago, New York, places like that. The problem there, as I've attended last year a conference in New York on black farmers and urban agriculture, that the land is never theirs. So at any time, they could have a crop out there and a good garden out there, and the owner of the property can come along and say, oh, I'm getting ready to build a parking deck, that kind of a thing. So land ownership is very important. We are overcrowded in the cities. If we had 10,000 black farmers raising 8 million pigs in the 1970s, why couldn't we have increased it by the 2 million that are being grown now in eastern North Carolina, which means 10 million being grown, and not do it in a way that contaminated the water, the air, and the soil.
Your work in civil rights didn't end at the farm, and it didn't end in the restaurants in Durham. In fact, you took it all the way to the Boy Scouts.
Well, you know, many times black people have to do what has to be done because no one else will do it. But in 1976, I believe it was, that they just said that the Boy Scouts of America was integrated and camporees would be integrated. And I go trucking down to Bonner with my 60 scouts and discover that there are probably 4,940 white scouts down there, and they put us as far back in the woods as they possibly could to start out with. And the fellows were complaining about that, and I'm saying, don't worry, you just do what you do. And all. And one of the major pieces that happens there is that you have to build flagpoles and raise your flag, your American flag, your troop flag. And these are the entryways to every campsite. And as we finished doing ours, we looked around us, and under every American flag, there was a rebel flag flying. So that is a signal, well, you're really not welcome here. So I send the patrol leaders over to have a discussion with the coordinators because I think children need to learn to be able to express themselves. And they go over and they talk to the leadership and they tell them it's nothing they can do. They come back and tell me. I go over and talk to the leadership. They tell me there's nothing that they can do. So my assistant scoutmaster was 18 years old, probably had never driven any further than Rocky Mount. And here we are down in Washington, North Carolina, not knowing where we are at all or anything. But at any rate, we send him to town to get us a piece of muslin material and some cater markers, red, black, and green, liberation colors. And he gets back about 9 o'clock that night, so we get everybody with their flashlights, and we make this black power flag with a big black fist that is outlined in red. And the next morning, as we do our flag-raising ceremony, you raise the American flag, and you call them to attention, and they pledge allegiance to the flag. And then you raise the troop flag, and you do your Boy Scout oath. Well, as the white troops did their American flag, they also raised the Confederate flag under it. So we didn't raise ours at that time. We then called back to attention and said salute, and 60 black fists went up in the air. We raised this flag under the American flag, and before we could get it tied off good, the leadership was over telling me that we could not do that. And I'm saying, what do you mean we can't do that? If you can fly the Confederate flag, I can certainly fly it. But you're going to cause trouble. I'm not causing any trouble. You're the one that's causing the trouble. I tell you what, you take them down and we'll take this one down. So in about 15 minutes, all of the Confederate flags are down.
Yeah.
And when we got home, we wrote to the Boy Scout and told them that, you know, of the experience. And my understanding is that you can no longer fly Confederate flags.
Interesting. Out of that. Yeah. I'm just surprised you couldn't. You had to make your own flag. They didn't have black power flags at the convenience store there? Had to make
Frank,
your own,
you,
huh?
You're really good.
But it had to be, or didn't have to be, let me ask you, wasn't it frightening?
You know, the young men now, for me now, it was very frightening because I had never considered that there were 4,000 white folk down there that who could have buried us in the back of that woods, and no one probably would have ever known what happened to us. But at the time, no, it was actually inspiring and strengthening, and that's what the fellows tell me that they felt.
And those young men, too, you sent the patrol leaders, in other words, the kids, right. Over.
Well,
I had prepared
them to go. I had taught them all of the songs that we sang, you know, We Shall Not Be Moved, and not going to let anybody turn me around, as we had prepared to go there to teach them. And then we talked about issues that would probably come up. However, I never thought that the issue would be the rebel flag flying under the American flag. And so we were not prepared for that, other than you go over there and tell them what it is that you believe.
So what do you think? Is there a plan? Is there a plan, and are you optimistic getting back to agriculture for preserving the tradition of farming among African Americans?
I think we are moving, but very slowly. One of the problems is that most black people grow up so poorly that if they get a college education, they are not looking to come back and suffer anymore. They go to work for the large agribusinesses, and we have to find a method to bring that knowledge back to the rural communities with us that will enable us to begin to become producers once again.
Gary, pleasure talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Gary Grant, founding president of the Black Farmers and Agriculturalist Association, executive director of the Concerned Citizens Fertility. That's our program. Thanks very much. If you want to see an archived edition, listen to it, you can go to our website, stateofthings.org, and you can find a calendar of events mentioned on the show. Our program is produced by Amber Nimix and Alex Granados. Robin Copley is our technical director. Managing editor Lindsay Foster Thomas. Susan Davis is our senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.